impact on, you know, our federal lands, just so folks can do additional mining. These are traditional lands. There is a cultural connection there. People have to continue to engage to fight back. You know, folks have been also going through legal challenges on many of these actions. We just have to continue to put a spotlight on it. And when the new administration comes in, they're going to have to use every tool that they have to reverse many of these decisions that will have long-term historical impacts in vulnerable communities across our country.
Mustafa Ali, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Former longtime head of the Environmental Justice Program at the Environmental Protection Agency, now vice president of the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you so much for joining us today. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Perk, Dina Guzder, Libby Rene, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh,
the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all, just ain't
specific. You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. And thanks.
There's so much that we need to share. So send a smile and show you care.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's one-day special legislative session is disrupted by far-right protesters. Congress agrees to a $900 billion stimulus plan, and people in the U.S. start receiving Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 21st, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon lawmakers began their third special legislative session this year on Monday morning as demonstrators outside tried to force their way into the Capitol. Governor Kate Brown called legislators back into session to extend the state's eviction moratorium, create a compensation fund for landlords, and allocate more money for the state's COVID-19 response and wildfire recovery work. Lawmakers are also considering proposals to shield schools from coronavirus lawsuits, as well as proposals to allow restaurants and bars to sell to-go cocktails and to cap the delivery fees they pay to third-party platforms. While meeting in the Capitol, lawmakers are being asked to follow certain regulations. That includes limiting their numbers in elevators, walking in only one direction down some hallways, and wearing face coverings while on the floor. Republican Senator Dallas Hurd of Roseburg objects to a statewide mask mandate. Hurd expressed his anger at the requirement on the Senate floor and then ripped off his mask and left the room. Several dozen demonstrators gathered outside the Capitol on Monday as part of a so-called non-permitted flash mob against COVID-19 restrictions. The event had been promoted by the Vancouver, Washington-based far-right group Patriot Prayer, whose leader Joey Gibson attended the demonstration. Protesters clashed with law enforcement outside the building as the session got underway Monday morning. Officers physically pushed demonstrators away from a doorway, and one officer appeared to deploy chemical spray. One group of demonstrators were able to gain access to an entry room in the building where they were blocked by authorities. The Oregon State Police declared an unlawful assembly, and two people who refused to leave the Capitol were arrested. The Oregon Health Authority reported 846 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 103,755. Oregon health officials also reported 6 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 1,347 people. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases on Sunday, with 212, followed by Clackamas County with 114 and Washington County with 108 cases. There are currently 528 people hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide, with 121 patients in the intensive care unit. Oregon health centers began administering the first COVID-19 vaccines produced by Pfizer last week. A panel of experts advising the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention voted on Saturday to endorse a new vaccine from Moderna, which clears the way for a second coronavirus vaccine in the U.S. The committee's recommendation follows an emergency use authorization granted by the Food and Drug Administration on Friday. The first shipments of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine left a distribution site near Memphis, Tennessee on Sunday. About 5.9 million doses of the vaccine are slated for distribution. Nearly all of the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines are going to healthcare workers and residents of long-term care homes. Officials expect there will not be enough shots for the general population until spring, so doses will be rationed for the next several months. It is not yet clear when Oregon will receive its first doses of the Moderna vaccine, but Governor Kate Brown said on Sunday that an independent review of the vaccine's safety cleared it for use in Oregon and 4 other western states. Both the Moderna vaccine and the one from Pfizer require 2 doses given several weeks apart. Congressional lawmakers are racing to push through a bipartisan coronavirus relief bill by midnight tonight. A $900 billion coronavirus relief bill was agreed to on Sunday afternoon, but it still has to be voted on to become official. The relief bill is a hard-fought one, since Congress has been unable to come to agreement about more coronavirus relief since the CARES Act expired in August. The bill provides for a second round of stimulus checks and additional aid for the unemployed. It leaves out some bigger questions that were sticking points for both parties. For example, Republicans were pushing hard for liability shields for businesses, meaning businesses would be protected from lawsuits related to coronavirus safety. Democrats were also set on providing state and local funding in the new bill. Ultimately, both sides dropped their more contentious priorities and instead agreed to the bill, which will fill in the gap until President-elect Biden takes office in late January. The new relief will give $600 to everyone who makes under $75,000 a year and will also issue $600 additional dollars for dependents. It also extends jobless benefits through March, meaning that those out of work will receive an additional $300 per week. Under the CARES Act, unemployment aid was $600 a week, and stimulus checks were double what they are this time. The hope is that the stimulus can tide workers over until the coronavirus vaccine is widely available in mid-2021. Critics say it is not nearly enough. The funding expires right around when President-elect Biden will take office, meaning increased aid will likely be a top priority for the new administration. City and law enforcement officials in Portland announced new steps Friday to address this year's surge in gun violence. Initial plans include assigning more detectives to investigate shooting cases and an increased presence of trauma responders at crime scenes where shootings have occurred. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler requested that the police bureau create new budget requests to include the heightened priority of gun violence. Police accountability advocates say these solutions fail to address the root causes of crime and violence. Instead, they fear the city's proposed plans will mean a return of the bureau's gun violence reduction team. Portland police point to the loss of its unit specializing in gun violence as the reason for this year's sharp increase in gun injuries and deaths. The Bureau's gun violence reduction team was disbanded this summer due to the fact that it disproportionately targeted people of color. It was previously called the Gang Enforcement Team, but later rebranded to attempt to distance itself from its discriminatory history. Portland's gun violence numbers were already trending upward before this year's pandemic, while the gun violence reduction team was still operating. According to Chief Lovell, this year's gun violence rates are double those of 2019. A study of 51 American cities found murder rates up nearly 36% nationwide over the last year. Portland's rate, at the time of the study, was up 43%. Teresa Rayford is a longtime Portland activist and founder of the accountability group Don't Shoot PDX. Rayford told OPB, quote, "There's still people dying because they don't have good, healthy food to eat or a place to live, and so guess what? The crime that's connected to poverty in black communities is exacerbated." Rayford expressed frustration with the city's constant data collecting at a time when real actionable solutions are needed, saying, quote, "There's still no placement of accountability to our leaders to do anything about it. There are no resources except for the resource of rhetoric." American consumers have been urged to support black-owned businesses this holiday season, and a Minnesota group for black entrepreneurs says there's still time to buy items from these businesses. But it also says that long-term support is needed, not only from customers, but from banks and other institutions, too. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The holiday shopping season is winding down, but a Minnesota group says consumers still should keep black-owned businesses in mind for last-minute gifts. And after this year's racial reckoning, there's renewed calls for long-term support from customers as well as banks. It's been more than 6 months since the police killing of George Floyd. Kenya McKnight Ahad runs the Black Women's Wealth Alliance, which has helped more than 200 women of color start businesses across the region. She says those who made pledges to stand with the black community can take a big step by supporting these entrepreneurs. She adds that online purchases could transform a lot of smaller companies just starting out.
We're so used to doing business hand to hand. You know, we have passion businesses. You know, we work from our cultural spaces. And now we're having to engage this online presence that we have a lot of deficits in.
She says broader customer support could help cover the cost of these investments. Through December 31st, the Alliance has a special digital marketplace showcasing black women-owned businesses. McKnight Ahad says some regional banks and foundations have followed through on their social justice goals, but she says many are short-term and that longer commitments still are needed, as well as assistance in qualifying for any new federal relief from Congress. A recent analysis by the Federal Reserve found that just 20% of loans from this year's Paycheck Protection Program reached areas with a high concentration of black-owned companies. McKnight Ahad says there was a big disconnect with that rescue effort.
Some banks wanted statements from a year ago, and it was a lot of different criteria that most sole proprietors don't have access to.
She says banks need to do a better job of creating access to accounts and providing education, making it easier for black-owned businesses to qualify for relief programs. Economists say these entrepreneurs already were at a disadvantage before the pandemic and have taken a major hit to their bottom line since the crisis unfolded. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
Congress approves a second pandemic relief package, and the Trump campaign continues its legal efforts. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The virus continues to spread throughout our country. Thousands of Americans are being robbed of their lives on a daily basis.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell led Republicans to finally reach agreement with Democrats on a second pandemic rescue package Sunday afternoon. After a rare weekend session, the $900 million measure will be attached to the $1.4 trillion omnibus spending bill to fund the government for this fiscal year. Also this weekend, President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris gather their environmental and transportation nominees at an event in Wilmington, Delaware.
Our climate crisis is not a partisan issue, and it is not a hoax.
The team will lead Biden's plans to reach net zero emissions by 2050 and a carbon-neutral power sector by 2023. Former Secretary of State John Kerry will coordinate domestic and foreign climate policy, along with former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy.
Environmental protection is part of my moral fiber. It's what I live for.
Biden's picks that need Senate confirmation include former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, North Carolina's top environmental regulator Michael Reagan, former 2020 candidate Pete Buttigieg, and New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland, the first indigenous person ever nominated to serve as Interior Secretary.
This moment is profound when we consider the fact that a former Secretary of the Interior once proclaimed his goal to, quote, civilize or exterminate us.
The nominees represent a policy agenda that differs dramatically from that of the Trump administration. Unfazed by the long string of legal losses, the Trump campaign is again petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court, this time to reverse three decisions from Pennsylvania's high court and ultimately have state lawmakers pick their own slate of electors. Even without Pennsylvania's electoral votes, Biden has a wide enough margin to still win. Trump is denying reports he's considering calls for martial law. After General Mike Flynn told a reporter the idea of deploying the military to rerun the election was discussed at the Oval Office, top Army officials have confirmed the military has no role in the outcome of an election.
I worry to the extent that the public does not have faith in the outcome the way the public really should.
Electoral College expert Edward Foley from Ohio State University says the continued efforts to refute the election results are clouding its success. While a swath of Republicans still don't trust the outcome, Foley hopes healing can start when Congress formally accepts the electoral votes from the states.
The more bipartisanship there is on January 6th in accepting the outcome as a valid and correct outcome, the more we can go along to say, even if your side lost, it is the right result.
President Trump may now be reading his own tweets that he lost the election. Twitter updated the warning labels it applies to election misinformation. Claims of election fraud that had been labeled disputed will now read, quote, election officials have certified Joe Biden as the winner of the U.S. presidential election. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact on the Brink, Homelessness Before and During COVID-19. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 48. Today in history, in 2012, Gangnam Style by Korean rapper Psy becomes the first YouTube video to reach 1 billion views. The quote of the day is from South African cleric and human rights activist Desmond Tutu, who said, quote, do your little bit of good where you are. It's those little bits of good put together that overwhelm the world. President-elect Joe Biden announces his climate team, and Montana's Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force discusses its next steps. With those stories and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonio Gonzalez. Over the weekend, President-elect Joe Biden introduced members of his climate team, including Congresswoman Deb Haaland. Biden says he's nominating Haaland for Secretary of the Interior, touting her work on environmental issues.
As the first Native American cabinet secretary in the history of the United States of America, she'll be a true steward of our national parks, our natural resources, and all of our lands. The federal government has long broken promises to Native American tribes who've been on this land since time immemorial. With her appointment, Congresswoman Haaland will help me strengthen the nation-to-nation relationship, and I'm honored to accept that she's been willing, when I called her, to accept this critical role.
Haaland, in a three-minute speech, first acknowledged the lands of the Lenape people they were on in Delaware, accepted the nomination, and mentioned some of her struggles in life, including homelessness, using food stamps, and raising her child as a single mother. Holland says her struggles give perspective. She talked about her Pueblo culture, boarding schools, and federal Indian policies.
This moment is profound when we consider the fact that a former Secretary of the Interior once proclaimed his goal to, quote, civilize or exterminate us. I'm a living testament to the failure of that horrific ideology. I also stand on the shoulders of my ancestors and all the people who have sacrificed so that I can be here.
Holland says she spent much time outdoors learning to respect the earth and value resources, and says she's ready to serve. The Biden-Harris climate team will include the Secretary of Energy and Environmental and Climate Advisors. Montana's Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force met last week for an update. Of the 179 missing persons in the state, 29% are Native American. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas has more.
Presiding Officer and State Deputy Attorney General Melissa Schlichting announced she was leaving the position to start a new job with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Helena. The MMIP task force voted unanimously to appoint Ellie Bundy, a task force member and tribal council member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, as new presiding officer. In an update about current missing persons cases, Tina Chamberlain said 29 missing Natives are under 21 years old, and 17 of them have been missing for over a year.
We are mindful that this is an overrepresentation when you look at Native Americans in Montana by population. It is keeping in line with what we've seen month to month. I think that last month at 31% was probably our highest, but this is still a very high number of missing people.
The task force said their missing persons reporting website, created in partnership with Blackfeet Community College, is being updated to work better with local law enforcement. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes will be the second tribal nation to use the new website once it's fully operational. The task force also announced the CSKT finished their tribal community response plan. The plan is part of a federal Department of Justice project to develop protocols with tribal nations so federal, tribal, and state law enforcement work together more efficiently on missing persons cases. Ellie Bundy says the CSKT are prepared to assist other Montana tribes in creating their own protocols.
As other tribes here start working on their plans, CSKT is more than willing to help in any way we can.
The Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes will likely be the next tribal nation to join the project. I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
Holiday food boxes will be distributed Tuesday on the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota during a drive-up curbside event. The boxes are designed to help create a meal for families. They include various holiday food items. The Cheyenne River Youth Project is teaming up with the tribe's Indian Child Welfare Act office to host the holiday food box event. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Citizens of the United Houma Nation in Louisiana have long depended on the land for food and medicine. Climate change is now altering their way of life. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Citizens of the United Houma Nation in southeastern Louisiana say that the ground is literally disappearing beneath their feet. Members of this state-recognized tribe have long lived on the Gulf Coast, so their culture is intimately tied to the water and land.
Not only were we fishermen, but our entire food came from the land. And there were traditionally very few grocery stores in many of our bayous, simply because everything we needed, we had right there. And that includes our medicines.
Shenandoah Billiott is a citizen of the United Houma Nation and an assistant professor of social work at Arizona State University. She has studied how environmental changes affect the tribe. She says climate change has altered the timing and abundance of fish harvests, and dredging by the oil industry, combined with sea level rise, has allowed salt water to seep further inland. That makes it harder to grow food.
And the salt water is also killing off our trees, and trees are very important for our medicines and ceremonies, trees like the cedar and cypress.
This changing landscape makes it more difficult for the Houma to sustain their traditional way of life. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A new report lists the top 10 species being threatened by wildlife trafficking. They include the rufous hummingbird, which is killed for use as a love charm, and the pangolin, which has been linked to COVID-19. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A new report calls for a crackdown on the booming illegal wildlife trade, activity that's been linked most recently to the spread of COVID-19. The Endangered Species Coalition's 2020 top 10 list of trafficked animals includes the pangolin, a mammal sold at the live animal market where the coronavirus is thought to have made the jump to humans. Jeannie Dodds with the Endangered Species Coalition says this illicit trade harms both wildlife and people.
These species have been extracted from the wild by humans, so any transmission of virus is a human-caused problem. It's not a wildlife problem.
Some other species on the list include the scalloped hammerhead shark, diamondback terrapin, the tiger and the yellow-headed parrot, as well as the tokay gecko, pinto abalone, and the rufous hummingbird. A couple of plants also made the list, the saguaro cactus and the Venus flytrap. Dodds says over the past 10 years, authorities have discovered an underground market for hummingbirds, which are trapped and killed in some cultures to make love charms.
They're perceived to confer the ability to attract romantic attention. So they're often stuffed and filled with different types of herbs and are given spells that are set over them, and then they're sold illegally on the black market in states like California.
Andrea Jones, Director of Conservation for Audubon California, says the rufous hummingbird population declined 62% from 1966 to 2014, and multiple factors are to blame.
It's got a host of different threats, and a lot of those are related to development pressures, your loss of habitat, and also to climate change.
The coalition would like to see Congress take up the bipartisan Preventing Future Pandemics Act of 2020, which would prohibit the sale of live wild animals for food. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
More than 30 breweries are asking Congress to pass a bill protecting the Owyhee Canyon lands in southeast Oregon. The legislation would designate more than 1 million acres of the canyon lands as wilderness. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The effort to protect the Owyhee Canyon lands is getting support from a big Oregon industry that also relies on clean water, breweries. More than 30 breweries from across the state have sent a letter urging Congress to pass the Malheur Community Empowerment for the Owyhee Act before the year ends. Mike Brownis is co-founder of Migration Brewing, which is among the beer makers supporting the bill to protect the landscape.
Water is such an important aspect to the brewing community that taking care of that is very important to us.
The bill, introduced by Oregon Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley, would designate more than 1 million acres of the canyonlands as wilderness and more than 14 miles of the Owyhee River as wild and scenic. It also would protect grazing and land use laws. Wyden brought together local ranchers, business owners, conservation groups, and others to help craft the bill. Outdoor recreation is a big part of Oregon's economy. It supported 88,000 jobs and generated $7.2 billion in 2019, according to U.S. Department of Commerce numbers. Brownis says the Owyhees have touched him personally.
I've paddled the river multiple times and hiked some of the canyon a number of times, and it's really just a very special place, dear to my heart, and I'd really like to be able to share those experiences with children and grandchildren.
Breweries in Oregon also are a big slice of the economy. They support more than 31,000 jobs directly and indirectly and contribute nearly $4.5 billion to the state's economy each year, according to the Oregon Brewers Guild. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 21st, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Mullen, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegedoff, and Anthony Leiswitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it is Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 at Stage and Studio, host Dime Roberts highlights art, literature, and media. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
I'm Salima Hamarani, and on today's Making Contact. As the housing crisis expands across the country, more and more people find themselves living in encampments, trying to create a home with whatever they have. But even then, they face displacement.
I just couldn't believe it. Like, I'm back on the streets. I couldn't believe this. Like, why would you guys do that? Like, you know, you guys gave us hope, and then now you guys threw us back out there with the wolf. You know what I'm saying? Like, you guys know that we're fighting not with women, okay? We're fighting with dudes, men.
We take a look at the housing crisis in Oakland, California, and the waves of evictions people face even when they're already living on the street. And we talk to activists working with homeless communities during the coronavirus pandemic. The Bay Area has one of the highest homeless populations in the United States. In Oakland, for example, new encampments sprawl under freeways and abandoned lots. And there's something many residents have taught themselves to ignore on the way to work. Less visible, however, are the cycles of evictions unhoused people face at the hands of the city and the toll it takes. Reporter Lucy Kang follows two women as they struggle to find peace and safety on the street.
This is not even animal living standards, I don't think. Because I wouldn't even want my dogs to live out here. Seriously. Look at this place. This is a dump.
Monjoy Tracy Saley is putting on fake eyelashes in front of a mirror.
Sorry, I was using your mirror.
That's right.
She's sitting on the porch of a tiny house on a dirt lot. We're at the corner of Oakland's East 12th Street and 23rd Avenue, next to an overpass and train tracks. Most people would call this place a homeless encampment. But for people like Tracy, it's as close to home as they're going to find in the Bay Area, one of the regions that's hardest hit by the housing crisis. I visited in January of 2019. That's when I met Tracy. I also met a woman named Kimberly Medrano who lives here. Like Tracy, she says it's hard living in the encampment. There's been a lot of problems, like trash.
We only allow the trash to be picked up twice a week. You won't let us have garbage cans or dumpsters to put it in, so we're just throwing it on the ground. The rat population is crazy.
There's also a problem with the toilets. Officially, the city provided porta-potties, but the contractor didn't clean them on schedule, so they overflowed.
What I do is I crap in a bag and get rid of the bag, or I use a bucket and then pour the pee out.
There were fires?
Fires there all the time. Every other day there was some kind of fire. There's been major fires over there, people know.
And there were even a number of deaths.
Five deaths that happened here. Feel me, that ever since I've been here, five people have died on this ground because of natural causes, or they claim it natural causes, but I don't think so. I think it's because of them being outside and so cold, they get sick, you know? So then, you know, their body can't take because they're old and they die.
Despite all the problems, the residents of the encampment tried to make as best a life as they could. Take Kimberly, for example. She lived in a wooden structure with a smaller tent inside for a bedroom. She used a propane stove for heat, and she got her water from a nearby faucet.
And I would heat a little bit on the stove, and I'd have my bowl, and I'd have my mirror right there, and
You know, I'd wash my face and brush my teeth and whatever I needed to do. Take a bath sometimes, full bath.
Kimberly carved out a home in East 12th and 23rd that gave her some feeling of autonomy and stability. She stayed for that. And because there was no other place to go. The thing is, this encampment was the product of other evictions. Back in 2017, the city of Oakland, California, promised this land to an organization called The Village that ran a self-governed unhoused community. It was grassroots, backed by local support. And it had the potential to be more stable than most places. But things didn't work out. Tracy was living on a median strip on East 12th and 16th Avenue, a few blocks away. And then the city made her move, which it did to a lot of unhoused people around Oakland.
One day the city dump truck came over and said that, you feel me, we have to move from there or they're going to throw all our shit away. And then the people that can't move their stuff, they're going to get thrown away, whatever. So they put all their shit in their dump truck, literally put on a dump truck, came here and dumped us out of here.
Oakland Assistant City Administrator Joe DeVries says it was necessary to shut down the East 12th Street median.
That location was extremely problematic in some of the activity that was happening there. There were some fires. There were people that had built structures in the trees.
And the city thought it had a better idea. They evicted everyone off the median and then said they could move to East 12th and 23rd, where the city was just starting to provide some services. But there were too many people for this limited plot of land.
We did encourage them to move down to East 12th and 23rd. It was a small group, we think around 12, maybe up highest 15 people.
What does encouraged mean?
Well, it was one of the few times where people said, well, where should we go? And we said, well, if you want to go down here, there's going to be porta potties, weekly garbage service, and hand washing stations, which was a new thing. So at the East 12th median, we're like, all right, yeah, we are closing this. It's dangerous. You can't be here. We really feel strongly that we have to close this encampment. That one's just down the street. You can be there. Like, it just seemed like a logical thing to help with that process.
Around the same time, the city evicted several homeless encampments across Oakland. And word got out that the city was letting people stay at East 12th and 23rd. Here's Kimberly again.
There's 100 people there. 100 people. How much garbage do you think? And then people were just dumping stuff, like their garbage or their furniture, and we'd have to stop and say, look, people live here, don't do that. It made us look bad. We're not all bad people. We're not all lazy people. We're you know, because all it takes is one person to mess it up.
At East 12th and 23rd, everywhere I look are tents or tiny houses and piles of clothes, broken furniture, and trash bags. It feels like a place in transition, and that's because people are getting ready to move out. Not because of the overcrowding or the overflowing toilets. Not even because of the rats. But because the city is just days away from evicting everyone. It turns out that the city let the village build a community here before it knew the site had to be cleared for construction. So now everyone has to move, again, into another situation that the city thinks is a better idea. The eviction takes place over several days. As it starts, city workers descend on East 12th and 23rd. Kimberly describes frantically trying to save her things before they're destroyed.
It was really muddy. It was slippery. There was garbage everywhere, people stuff in the way. There was so many police officers, and mostly police officers and public works people. It was ridiculous. I mean, I had to go around them. So everything was broken in the street and everything. Nobody's helping us with traffic. Me and three of my neighbors, at least, were flattened already. There was nothing left.
When we think of displacement, we typically think of people being pushed out of apartments or houses, or people forced to move far from cities they used to live in. But there's another type of displacement that's happening in cities across the country. It happens over and over again, nearly every week. On the street, in tent cities or encampments, underpasses or public parks, people who have already lost their homes are forced to undergo the trauma of eviction, not once, not twice, but multiple times. People like Kimberly and Tracy. So what happens after Kimberly and Tracy get kicked out of East 12th and 23rd? Usually, they'd move to another encampment or back onto the sidewalks to await another eviction. But the city had launched a new program at the end of 2017 to temporarily shelter people in dozens of tough sheds, basically rudimentary two-person cabins made by the company that also makes backyard tool sheds. Oakland city officials call them community cabins. The city-run tough shed sites are meant to provide emergency shelter to residents for 6 months and then connect residents to support services.
I don't know if we want Talia or Laura to come over. I'm not sure if there's a, I mean, there's a, as you can see, there's still construction going on, but I'm not sure if they have a one particular unit they want you to see or not.
Assistant City Administrator Joe DeVries shows me the new site right before it's set to officially open.
And you can see, actually, that they're not tool sheds. There's bats of insulation underneath here, and then they have this vinyl.
They may be more stable than a tent under an overpass, but they also lack a lot of things houses would have.
They don't have full electrical, in part due to just cost and due to safety. We don't have running water at the sites. That's a heavy lift from a contracting point of view, from a construction point of view. But we do have Lava May providing shower services a few times a week.
The city's strategy was to open these sites while closing surrounding encampments. And not just on East 12th Street, but all over Oakland. The city originally said there would be enough space at the Tough Shed site for just about everyone getting displaced. But it turns out they didn't have enough spots for everyone. Here's Joe DeVries 4 months after the eviction.
There were more people at the site than originally were there when we did the census. It was really hard to figure out who actually lived there and who didn't.
Sort of from the beginning, there weren't enough spots at the Miller Tough Sheds to accommodate all the people in the encampment, no?
Well, it does mean that. But we don't have enough spots to accommodate the homeless in Oakland in emergency shelter right now. I mean, that's absolutely true.
That means the city forced a lot of people back onto the sidewalks after they closed the encampment at East 12th and 23rd. That's after the city encouraged people to move to the encampment. Fortunately, Tracy and Kimberly didn't end up on the street, at least not right away. They were both given spots in the tough sheds, which sounds great. A little cabin, all to yourself and one other person. A little warmer and more protected. But the sheds come with their own set of problems. They all had to agree to rules.
The rules are pretty lax. You pretty much just can't start fires, you can't sell drugs, and you can't be physically violent towards another person.
But there are more rules. Leave for more than 72 hours and you lose your spot. You're not allowed burners or open flames. And if you break the rules, you're asked to leave. According to figures the city sent me in July 2019, over 40% of people who left the Miller Avenue tough sheds were evicted for violating the rules. And after living self-sufficiently on the streets, or rather being forced to, some people found it hard to adjust to rules and authority. Here's Kimberly Medrano again.
Well, come to find out, we're not able to cook here at all. So it's hard. I'm used to cooking. Oh, we're starving, you know, and then we're at the mercy of whatever they cook for breakfast, which I don't really cook anything for breakfast. Just one day, maybe they heat something up. You're kind of at their mercy, and, you know, it's at the end of the month. I mean, I've lost weight. I know that because my bra is way too big. So unfortunately, that's where I lose it first. So.
And in the end, the tough sheds are not a permanent solution. You're only allowed to stay 6 months.
The hope is that we can move people out of there and into housing so that we can invite more people in.
But the city's data from July 2019 shows that only about a quarter of people at the Miller Avenue Tough Shed site went into housing after 6 months. For the remaining three quarters, people either abandoned the program or were kicked out. And what happens to them next underlines the human cost of these ongoing displacements. After the tough sheds, a few lucky residents did find housing, like Kimberly. Kimberly got subsidized housing through a program run by Kaiser Permanente and Bay Area Community Services, or BACS. She seems much more relaxed the next time I talk to her.
I guess specifically, how has your day-to-day, like, life changed?
Well, basically, I'm getting some sleep. Which I wasn't getting with the roommate I had in the tough sheds and the chaos. It's a lot more quiet. It's nice to be able to take a hot shower every day if I want to.
The program was subsidizing most of Kimberly's rent, but that stopped earlier this year. I wasn't able to reach Kimberly, though a BAC spokesperson did tell me that all participants were still in housing. I should also mention that a recent KPIX news investigation questioned BAC's long-term effectiveness. Ultimately, Kimberly says she wants to be on her own. She wants to buy a trailer.
It's like a little home, and it would be mine, and I could pay cash for it.
Most people, however, are not as lucky as Kimberly. Tracy, for example, is back on the streets, a block away from the old spot. When I talk to her this time, she's with Morgan, who's not using her real name. They were both in the Miller Avenue tough sheds around the same time, and they both got evicted after physical altercations with other residents. Evictions aren't new to Tracy and Morgan, but getting evicted from the city-run tough sheds hit hard because it was a place they were supposed to feel safe.
I just couldn't believe it. Like, I'm back on the streets. I couldn't believe this. Like, why would you guys do that? Like, you know, you guys gave us hope, and then now you guys just threw us back out there with the wolves. You know what I'm saying? Like, you guys know that we're getting, like, we're fighting not with women. Okay, we're fighting with dudes, men.
And for them, it's literally a life or death situation. Morgan says she was scared to go to sleep after she got evicted from the tough sheds.
On several occasions, one of my girlfriends, she woke up and there was somebody having sex with her. And the reason why she woke up to that is she was had been up for so long trying to stay awake that finally she passed out and went to sleep. Didn't mean to, but went to sleep. And when she woke up, that's what she woke up to.
Sexual and physical assault are disturbingly common among unhoused women. A 2014 study in San Francisco showed that 60% of unhoused women experience violence, including sexual violence, in the last 6 months. The women I spoke to thought about it a lot.
As a woman, you know, I shouldn't even have to go through what I went through. And as of a city, you know, they should have, you know, low-income housing for people to be able to stay inside so they don't have to live out here to put themselves at risk like this, you know? Because I'm fortunate that I'm still alive, but other people would probably not have made it like how I did, you know?
It's hard not to feel overwhelmed by the scale of homelessness and stories from women like Tracy and Morgan and Kimberly. But women like them are also on the forefront of changing how the city responds. Oakland is a testing ground for solutions that come from unhoused people and women in particular. They include self-governed tiny house encampments like The Village, or the orchestrated squatting campaigns like Moms for Housing that target corporately owned buildings sitting empty all over Oakland. At least some of the answers to the homelessness crisis will come and have to come from unhoused people themselves who are living on the streets and know all too well what's at stake if they can't find safe places to live. This is Lucy Kang, reporting for Making Contact from Oakland, California.
You were just listening to reporter Lucy Kang talking about the ongoing raids on homeless encampments and the emotional and physical toll they take on the people who live there. And you're listening to Making Contact. To listen to any past shows, visit radioproject.org. Subscribe to our podcast, get our updates, or support our work at radioproject.org. Reporter Lucy Kang worked on that piece before the coronavirus pandemic, so we wanted to do an update on her segment by taking a look at how homeless communities are dealing with COVID-19. And for that, we got in touch with Candace Elder, Executive Director of the East Oakland Collective. So Candace, how are people you're working with, particularly the homeless, responding to COVID-19?
They are responding as best as they can. Curbside communities have experienced sanitation issues before COVID-19. So that's lack of access to showers, portable toilets, hand washing stations, trash pickup. And then after COVID-19 shelter in place, folks who had gym memberships, you know, the gym is closed, so they can't even use the gym to take a shower, to wash their hands, to clean up. There were the mobile shower buses, and I believe some of them have suspended their services due to health and safety concerns. So people are relying on supplies, but then the supplies are scarce. You know, there's like no hand sanitizer in the world right now.
And how are people in curbside communities dealing with the shelter in place order?
So I think our unhoused residents are very resilient. A lot of, especially like the seniors that I work with who are living on the streets, they kind of shelter in place anyways for safety reasons, because they're afraid, you know, they go outside and they're away for too long, that their stuff would be stolen. You know, they have pets and things to watch over. I am seeing the fear starting to increase a little bit because they're lacking supplies. And then now with the curbside communities are suffering from food scarcity, that's when it hit home for a lot of people. So the agencies such as EOC and a lot of my colleagues, a lot of the even larger like nonprofits, the soup kitchens, folks are closed. So EOC, we have been scrambling to find new food sources. We were serving pre-COVID-19, we were serving 400 meals a week and our caterer closed. So now we have been scrambling and working with generous and gracious donations from restaurants. We're exploring getting excess produce from farmers market. So we're just having to improvise.
Across the country, homeless encampments are among the most vulnerable communities when it comes to disease. And that's been true even before COVID-19. There have been outbreaks already in streetside communities of diseases like hepatitis and even so-called medieval diseases like typhus. And that's because of sanitation problems and because it's hard to do, quote, social distancing on the street.
Fight the spread of COVID. Hotels for the homeless.
These protesters are in their cars outside of the Moscone Center in San Francisco. The Moscone Center is basically a huge open auditorium in which the city wanted to house the homeless during the pandemic. Beds were placed on the floor 6 feet apart, and residents would be breathing in the same air in an enclosed space. It's basically a massive shelter, and that makes Candace worried.
Because shelters is just a mass of people in one room. They're sleeping, walking, and breathing in very close proximity to a lot of people. And that's the problem with shelters. That's the problem with the city of Oakland's tough shed cabin communities when there's two strangers to a room. So we're trying to lessen contact between people to prevent an outbreak.
Candace, like the protesters you can hear, have a better idea.
We're outside Mayor Lemon Breed's press conference right now, where she has said that she was going to put the thousands of people who are on the streets of San Francisco into housing, into hotel rooms. She hasn't done it yet. We're demanding that those people get into housing, get into safe, healthy spaces to live. We need housing for the homeless. We need hotels for the homeless to fight the spread of COVID.
Let's open up these hotel rooms, not only for those who are sick or showing symptoms, but, you know, hotel rooms for any unhoused person so that they can actually shelter, truly, truly shelter in place.
That was Candace Elder, executive director of the East Oakland Collective. And just as an update, the protest outside of the Moscone Center successfully convinced the city of San Francisco not to shelter the homeless there. Protesters are continuing to push the city to use empty hotel rooms instead. So in the first half of the show, our reporter Lucy Kang followed two women as they underwent several evictions, even though they were already homeless. We wanted to end our show talking about why so many people are forced to live on the street and what we can possibly do to combat the housing crisis. Joining us is Noni Session.
My name is Noni Session. I am a third generation West Oaklander, an anthropologist, researcher, and the executive director of the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative.
Noni argues that we need to totally change the way that we think about homelessness.
There is this sort of overall thing we call the housing crisis, which is not really a housing crisis. It's a distribution crisis. It's a political crisis. There's the thing called mass homelessness, right? But what it is racialized displacement.
In fact, she argues that we need to start thinking about housing as a right, a human right, and not as something that we're forced to earn through the market.
If there was someone withholding water, right, withholding food from a family, it would become very clear to you that that was cruel, that it was anti-human, right? if we extract housing from that really kind of insidious symbolic framework called the commodity, then it brings it into the question of humanity and the purpose of cities and governments, which is to take care of its people and make sure its people have their basic needs.
Activists have been pushing governments to treat housing as a basic need for decades now, like this group of women who took over empty homes in Los Angeles. They call themselves Reclaiming Our Homes, and they're modeled on a similar direct action that started in Oakland called Moms for Housing. Here's some members of Reclaiming Our Homes.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ruby. I'm a parent of three. We've been having a very difficult housing situation for some time. We are urging that vacant houses become homes. What we're going to do is we're going to occupy this house, make it a home. We're going to bring life to it, not only in the inside with human beings, but on the outside.
Hello, my name is Marta Escudero. I am from Reclaiming Our Homes. I was born and raised here in California. And when I was growing up, Skid Row was in downtown LA. And now all of California is Skid Row. All of California. That's a shame on the government. There are over hundreds of houses here that are abandoned for 30 years while there's people in tents, families and seniors the most vulnerable. And that's why I'm urging the governor to stand by our side and meet our demands. We want all these houses to be occupied by human beings now, immediately.
Right on.
Vacant lots, vacant houses. Especially now with the coronavirus, it is really a safety hazard to have all these people on the streets while there's empty houses. They're state owned and they're empty. So we're not doing anything wrong. All the reclaimers are in vulnerable housing situations. For myself, I'm a mother of two daughters, and we've been in unstable housing for a year and a half. And they have this anxiety due to that. And it increases our vulnerability to illness, not only mental health, but physical as well.
Right.
This is a health hazard.
Housing is a human right.
Medical care is a human right. Housing is our human right.
Okay, so Noni, you know we just heard from some members of Reclaiming Our Homes who had to forcibly take over an empty building for shelter during COVID-19. And my question for you is, what surprised you about the way the cities responded to COVID-19 and what they say they can and cannot do?
The thing that has most surprised me is that the capital has become available to emergency house folks when folks have been struggling with our city and municipality for at least since 2011 to provide emergency housing for folks to get them off the street and to channel food and support and resources to them, when we've been told that there's no money available for it, there's no organizational and infrastructural way to hold that work. But it has suddenly appeared out of budgets that were otherwise kept opaque.
So, okay, do you think there's a way to use that momentum in a time of crisis to keep pushing society to be more fair?
This is the thing about capitalist production. Is emergency capitalism is how we're all kept off balance. There's always capital available for the emergency because there's always reserve capital. But when you are trying to access that capital to normalize people, to build dignified housing, there is when you are not going to be able to access capital under this new economy that needs to have really vulnerable and destabilized people.
Noni, so then you think this shift, the excess capital we're seeing right now, is temporary?
I like what I'm seeing, right? I'm seeing a lot of solidarity networks forming. And so where I believe that we can extend our organizing is where almost every sustained political movement has extended its organizing. To the actual Black and brown folk who are the subject of the capitalist mill, right? And so it's really great to see the white folk and the privileged folk and even the working class and working poor folk coalescing around this vision. And we need to bring a larger segment of our community into this vision and into this conversation.
You were just listening to Noni Session, Executive Director of the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative,
talking about market forces in the housing crisis and how to combat them. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about the housing crisis and coronavirus? Join the conversation on Facebook. Our Twitter handle is making_contact. And on Instagram, we're Making Contact Radio Project. The Making Contact team includes Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, Aisha Chowdhury, Lisa Rudman, Catherine Steyer, and I'm Salima Hamarani. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people,